Knowledge Products presents The Giants of Philosophy. Socrates, narrated by Lynn Redgrave. Part 1.
One of the great ironies of Western civilization is that many philosophical movements have claimed Socrates as their intellectual ancestor, yet the ancient Greek philosopher said he had no doctrines to teach. What's more, Socrates' influence on Western culture is hardly limited to philosophy. He has come to symbolize the relentless pursuit of truth, regardless of the consequences. Socrates has become an ideal of intellectual honesty for all disciplines. Socrates apparently wrote nothing of any consequence. If he did, it has not survived. So what we know of him must be drawn from the testimony of others who knew him or knew of him. And while that testimony is considerable, it hardly provides a coherent picture of the man and his philosophy. It's difficult to decide which, if any, of these very different portraits is the best likeness of the real Socrates. This is known as the Socratic problem, and it continues to divide scholars even today. In antiquity, there was no shortage of Socraticoi logoi, or writings about Socrates. But most of these writings have been lost over the centuries, and much of what has survived cannot be entirely trusted. Plutarch, the Greek biographer of the 1st century AD, wrote his account of Socrates some 5 centuries after Socrates was alive. Diogenes Laertius, a biographer in the 3rd century AD, wrote 7 centuries after Socrates had lived. Fortunately, several substantial works have survived from 3 of Socrates' contemporaries: the comic poet Aristophanes, the historian Xenophon, and the philosopher Plato. Each of these authors probably knew Socrates well, and their testimonies offer us a fuller account of the historical Socrates and his philosophy. The least helpful of the 3 contemporary writers is Aristophanes. Although Socrates is mentioned in several of his plays, Aristophanes actually gives a central character the name Socrates in the play entitled Clouds. According to Plato, Socrates himself told the jury at his trial that Aristophanes' portrayal of him as an atheistic sophist had created a great deal of the prejudice against him in Athens. There is no question but that the Socrates character in Clouds tries to undermine the established values of Athenian society. Aristophanes has Socrates tell a potential student,
"There is no god at all, except the ones we believe in. Chaos, the clouds, and tongue. These alone are our gods. The others, Zeus and the rest, are nonsense. There is no Olympian Zeus."
Many Athenians were convinced after seeing the play that the real Socrates was an atheist and a sophist. Socrates became known for his supposedly devious reasoning. Commentators now generally agree that Aristophanes intended the character Socrates to be a composite of the so-called new intellectuals. This was a mixed group of thinkers, sophists, and proto-scientists who questioned the orthodox thinking of the day. Aristophanes probably chose Socrates as a symbol for the group because his philosophizing openly challenged the received moral opinions of that time. Moreover, Socrates' disheveled appearance and his many eccentricities made him an instantly recognizable figure, and a comic one at that. The Socrates character in Clouds is really a pastiche, a character that espouses a mixture of attitudes and positions, each exaggerated for comic effect. Nevertheless, it's likely that comments by the character Socrates in Clouds are actually similar to comments by the historical Socrates. Which views belong to the historical Socrates, however, we cannot say with certainty. Xenophon wrote extensively about Socrates, but his writing did little to settle the Socratic problem. He wrote a multi-part reminiscence of Socrates entitled The Memorabilia, along with a dialogue about Socrates' views entitled Symposium. Both are clearly intended to put the philosopher in the best light possible. This Socrates is so filled with conventional platitudes and pious homilies that it becomes difficult to see why the Athenians could ever view the man as a threat to anything. Here is one of Xenophon's characteristically bland descriptions.
"Socrates neither said nor did anything impious regarding the gods. And what he said and did regarding the gods were what one says and does who is and is thought to be most pious. He was of all men the most in control of his passions and appetites. He was the most determined in the face of cold and heat and all adversity. And having been taught to need only what is moderate, when he procured very little, he was altogether content. Being this sort of person, how could he have made others impious, lawbreakers, greedy, licentious, or weak?
According to Xenophon, Socrates threatens no one, and his philosophical acumen is so slight that it's difficult to see how Socrates attracted bright young men, as we know he did. As we turn to Plato's picture of Socrates, we should be cautious about which Platonic works are counted as evidence. Today, most scholars agree that some of the works bearing Plato's name are not genuine. Of the 27 or so works produced by the hand of Plato, most feature a character named Socrates, who usually leads the discussion. There are good reasons to think that not all of these characters could represent the views of the historical Socrates. So which, if any, of the Platonic dialogues develop the views of the genuine Socrates? We can begin to answer this question by dividing Plato's dialogues into three groups. These correspond to an early, a middle, and a late period in Plato's career. The Socrates appearing in the dialogues of the latter two periods expresses a wide range of technical philosophical interests. By contrast, the Socrates of the early period is concerned with moral issues, and he constructs his arguments exclusively from the responses of others who participated in his discussions. Most commentators now agree that Socrates, as depicted in Plato's middle and late periods, was a mouthpiece for Plato. In other words, the middle and late Socrates discusses views that Plato himself accepted at the time. It may seem, then, that the Socrates of Plato's earlier dialogues must therefore represent the views of the real Socrates, but this is not necessarily true either. The Socratic problem probably cannot be solved decisively, but we should keep in mind that Socrates, as depicted in the early Platonic dialogues, seriously challenges the moral orthodoxy of 5th century Athens. So it's not hard to understand why defenders of the moral status quo, such as the prominent politician Anytus, as well as Melitus, who prosecuted Socrates, would have wanted to silence him. Consider, for example, that in Plato's dialogue entitled Meno, Socrates suggests that some leading Athenian citizens had failed to improve their children. Socrates begins with a series of rhetorical questions about a citizen named Themistocles. This is the same famous general and statesman who was instrumental in forging the successful Athenian strategy in the Greek war against the Persians.
Do you say that Themistocles was a good man? And if any man was a good teacher of his virtue, this man was. But do you think he would have wished others to become noble and good, most of all his son? Or do you think that he envied his own son and purposefully denied him the virtue which was his own? Did you ever hear from anyone, young or old, that Cleophantus, the son of Themistocles, was as good and wise a man as his father?
After running through a series of such questions, Socrates concludes that virtue must not be teachable. In the process, Socrates offended by name some of the most important people in the city. Plato's early dialogues enable us to see why bright, young, philosophically minded men in Athens would have been attracted to Socrates. The Socrates depicted here is interested in far more than merely asking questions and revealing the ignorance of others. He is a serious philosopher whose intriguing, positive views provide a complex moral theory. It's not surprising that this philosopher would have had a significant following of people who later developed their own sophisticated views. Finally, in addressing the Socratic problem, we must consider the testimony of Aristotle. Socrates and Aristotle were not contemporaries, but Aristotle studied and taught in Plato's school, the Academy, for 20 years. Aristotle was in an excellent position to know what the actual Socrates thought, and he often refers to Socrates' views in his writings. There's reason, then, to think that Aristotle's report of Socrates is accurate. And since Aristotle's Socrates fits very nicely with the Socrates of Plato's early period, we can reasonably suppose that Plato's early dialogues also say something significant about the historical Socrates. Therefore, when we refer to Socrates, we will have Plato's early testimony in mind. Now that we've established what we don't know about Socrates, it's time to discuss what we do know. Socrates was born in 469 BC in the Greek city-state of Athens. He lived his entire life there, and his family lived modestly. Diogenes Laertius, writing many centuries after the death of Socrates, tells us,
Socrates was the son of Sophroniscus, a stoneworker, and of Phinarete, a midwife.
In all likelihood, Socrates learned his father's trade, but there is no credible evidence that he practiced it. Little is known about Socrates' youth, but it is important to note that he was born as Athens was entering the most exhilarating phase of her history. The mid-5th century BC was the beginning of a golden age in Athenian culture. Drama, sculpture, and architecture flourished, and the artifacts that have survived are monuments to the creative brilliance of the period. In political life, democratic rule came into its own. The key assumption of this democratic order was that every male born within the boundaries of Athens could, when he reached manhood, vote, hold office, and serve on juries. This was also a time of intellectual revolution. Traveling teachers, known as sophists, challenged commonly held notions about religion, science, and ethics. For example, there was Thrasymachus, a 5th century BC teacher of rhetoric, who ridiculed the value of behaving justly.
The just man everywhere comes out worse than the unjust man. First, in their dealings with each other, where the one enters into a partnership with the other, nowhere will you discover that the just man comes out with more than the unjust man, but less. And then, in those matters pertaining to the city, whenever there are taxes, the just man pays more than what is equal, and the unjust less. Or when there is a distribution of good, the just man gains nothing, but the unjust man gets much of it. And when each holds office, it belongs to the just man, if he suffers no other penalty, to have his own affairs suffer, and to benefit nothing from the state because of his justice, and to displease his relatives and acquaintances, when he would not be willing to serve them on account of his injustice.
Words like these apparently persuaded many Athenians to use their formidable military to attract allies who could help pay for expensive civic projects. After the Persian Wars, Athens formed an alliance with dozens of independent Greek islands, all of whom agreed to cooperate in defending Greece against future Persian attacks. The Athenian Assembly then offered its allies the unattractive alternatives of paying taxes or being annihilated, and this is how Athenian civic projects were funded. As Socrates grew to manhood, Athens, the mother of democracy, turned into a rapacious tyrant. As the Athenian lust for power grew, the city clashed with Sparta, the other major power among the Greek city-states. The Peloponnesian War erupted in 431 BC when Socrates was 39 years old. According to Plato, Socrates served in the ranks of the heavily armored Athenian soldiers. In this, he was no different from thousands of other Athenians, but his valor on the battlefield was anything but ordinary. An Athenian general named Laches, who is quoted in one of Plato's dialogues, says that Socrates exemplified honor and courage.
I watched Socrates elsewhere doing the right thing by his country. He accompanied me during the retreat from Delium. And I tell you that if the others had wished to be like him, the honor of our city would have been upheld, and we would not have endured such a disaster.
In another Platonic dialogue entitled The Symposium, a brilliant politician and general named Alcibiades declares that Socrates had an incredible capacity to endure the rigors of military life.
First, with regard to the hardships, he was superior not only to me, but to all the others as well. When we had been cut off somewhere and we were unable to get food, as happens on campaigns, the others couldn't compare to his endurance. Moreover, when he feasted, he was singularly able to enjoy, and though not wanting to drink, when he was forced, he outdid us all. Yet, what is most amazing of all, no one has ever witnessed Socrates drunk. But among the other things he did, I marveled at his endurance in winter. Once there was a really terrible frost, and either we did not go out, or if anyone did, we wrapped up incredibly well, putting on our shoes and wrapping our feet in woven wool and sheepskin. But Socrates went out in these conditions, wearing the same cloak he was accustomed to wearing. Going barefooted, he walked more easily over the ice than did the others who were wearing shoes.
All ancient commentators agree that Socrates had absolute control over his emotions and desires. This is not to say that he was an ascetic, that is, one who tries to avoid physical pleasure altogether. When Socrates could enjoy himself, he did. But when conditions called for him to endure hardship, he did that too, and with no complaint. Socrates was not a handsome man, far from it. By all accounts, his bulging eyes, snub nose, and round belly made him singularly unattractive. More than one ancient source compared his appearance to that of a satyr, half goat and half man. Socrates' appearance made him a favorite target of the comic poets, who also must have gotten more than a few laughs from Socrates' unusual mannerisms. For example, Socrates would roll his eyes with his head cocked backwards as he walked through the streets of Athens. One surviving fragment from a 5th century comic poet, Amepsius, offers a depiction of Socrates that makes fun of his tattered cloak and his habit of going barefooted.
Come here, Socrates!
The complete fool!
Can we get you a cloak?
He is an insult to the shoemakers.
Socrates' appearance and mannerisms were not the only things that made him stand apart from his fellow Athenians. He often claimed that he heard a voice, which he sometimes called his daimonion, or divine voice. Socrates used the voice to guide his actions, and all the ancient sources about his life are in rare agreement that he was entirely convinced that the voice had a divine origin. But the sources disagree on what the voice communicated. For example, Plato insists that the voice acted only to stop Socrates from what he was about to do. It never provided positive guidance. To the contrary, Xenophon claims that Socrates' daimonion often gave positive advice. Whichever account is correct, it is plain that there was a side of Socrates that would not fit our modern conception of purely rational behavior. At some point, Socrates married a woman named Xanthippe, who may have been from an aristocratic family. Together, they had 3 sons. Some ancient sources claim that Socrates also had another wife, Myrto, but these stories should be viewed with suspicion. A second wife is not mentioned by Plato or Xenophon, our 2 best sources about the life of Socrates. If Socrates did marry twice, then Xanthippe could have been his second wife, because Plato says she was in Socrates' prison cell on the last day of his life. During Socrates' lifetime, stories were commonly told about his endurance for Xanthippe's uncontrolled temper. Xenophon offers a typical report of a conversation between Socrates and his friend Antisthenes. When Socrates claims that women can learn anything, Antisthenes asks in jest,
"Why then, Socrates, do you not educate Xanthippe? For you chose the most difficult woman of those who exist, of those who have existed, and of those who will exist."
Socrates responds with characteristic humor,
"Because I see that those who wish to become horsemen do not take on the obedient horses, but rather those that are high-spirited. For they believe that if they are able to keep them in check, it will be easier to take care of the other horses. But since I wish to associate and deal with human beings, I have gotten her for myself, knowing well that if I can endure her, I can easily be with all other human beings.
This is the end of part one. Please download part two to continue.